The Armed Forces Radio Service invites you to share in the vivid, colorful stories just between us. Stories as told by one of America's master yarn spinners, Knox Manning.
This is Knox Manning with a few remarks just between us about a unique landing aboard a carrier, an emperor's big mistake, unusual wedding rings, and the second-hand dealer. Landing a plane on the deck of a carrier requires an amount of skill under normal circumstances. When, in addition, the situation is complicated by the fact that the plane is damaged and the flyer not only wounded but blinded, making a successful landing sounds like a pretty impossible maneuver. Yet, that thrilling feat is exactly what happened recently on the flight deck of the carrier Philippine Sea. The incident was the first of its kind in the United States Navy aviation history. This is how it all started. While flying his jet plane at 350 miles an hour during strikes over the Han River south of Seoul, Ensign Edward D. Jackson, Jr. of Memphis, struck a booby-trap cable strung by North Korean communists to prevent low-level bombing and strafing. He was knocked unconscious. The jet's right wingtip was shattered, and the windshield and canopy were smashed. He regained consciousness about 20 seconds later, and Ensign Jackson found his eyes clouded with blood from face cuts. The jet was climbing in a steep turn. Leveling off and reducing speed to lessen the terrific wind force in the open cockpit, Ensign Jackson then radioed his plight to his wingman, Ensign Dale E. Crow. In close formation, with the wingman guiding the injured pilot via radio, the two jets flew the 120 miles back to the carrier. As the crucial moment for landing approached, Ensign Crow jockeyed the blinded pilot into a landing approach position. On deck, the carrier's landing signal officer dropped his hand signals to give directions by radio, and Ensign Jackson began his breathtaking landing. The jet, which was capable of more than 600 miles per hour, eased gently to the deck, landing slightly to one side, but otherwise, according to the Navy, a normal landing. As the plane bounced to a standstill, a flight surgeon climbed to the cockpit and wiped the blood from the pilot's eyes. Then, for the first time, Ensign Jackson saw the flight deck. To tell you anything else would be anticlimactic, but I must tell you that several days later, Ensign Jackson, recovered from injuries, was launched from the carrier for a test flight in his repaired plane. Such is the stuff our fighting men are made of. You know, there's one human failing which seems to be universal. The chances are everybody has a touch of it in his makeup. I'm talking about the failure to appreciate what we already have until we're on the verge of losing it or have lost it. We're that way about our health. We don't usually value it or take proper care of it until it begins to slip or is lost. We often have the same attitude toward our jobs, our friendships, our homes, and even our families. Many a man or woman has rushed into the divorce court after a petty quarrel with his wife or husband and got a separation by law, only to find out afterwards what a mistake he'd made and how much this ex-husband or wife really meant to him or to her. We don't appreciate the joy of having young children at home. Kids are an awful bother. That is, we don't until they've grown up and gone, and then we know. As the old song says, we never miss the sunshine until the shadows fall. And I guess most of us don't. The most common reasons why people fail to value what they have while they have it is because they're always looking for something more, something bigger, shinier, or better. Sometimes, though less often with ordinary people, it's because they have so much that they don't even know what they do have. This was the case with an old-time Chinese emperor. Emperor Yuan Ti was of the Han Dynasty. He had so many concubines in his royal harem that he never even set eyes on most of them. What he saw in most instances was only their portraits. The court painter, whose name was Mao Yanshu, painted each concubine's picture. The emperor looked at that and decided whether or not he was interested. Naturally, it was considered a great honor and a great triumph for a gal when the emperor ordered her to be brought before him. The concubines tried to win the court painter's favor by giving him presents, so that when he painted their portrait, he'd make it look very beautiful, and the emperor would want to see them. A girl named Chao Chun was the loveliest of all the emperor's concubines, but she didn't bother to bribe the court painter with gifts because she had such confidence in her natural beauty and charm. She was sure that her portrait would be attractive enough if Mao Yanshu painted her just as she actually looked. But the court painter, because this gal hadn't given him any presents, spitefully painted a portrait of her that wasn't anywhere near as beautiful as she really was. So the Emperor didn't send for her, and he never knew how lovely she was until it was too late. A while after this portrait was painted, the Shang Yu, the great Khan of the Huns, as he was called in Europe, paid his first visit to the court of Peking. The Emperor of China, wanting to stand in good with this powerful neighbor of his, decided he'd offer the great Khan a wife. And the one he gave him was the beautiful Chao Chun, whom the Emperor had never seen. When the Khan and his bride appeared before the Emperor, at the time the visiting big boy was taking his leave, the Emperor was so astonished when he saw how beautiful the girl was that all he could do was stare at her with his mouth hanging open. He couldn't say a word. And now he'd gone and given away this transcendentally lovely beauty, not knowing how wonderful she was. As soon as the great Khan left, taking his bride with him, the Emperor gave the court painter and the concubines who'd bribed him their comeuppance. And how? That very same day, he had their heads cut off in the marketplace. But the Emperor never forgot Chao Chun's beauty. He was always haunted by bitter regrets for the happiness he might have had if he had only known. Since we mentioned wives, let's keep in the wedding vein. You know that ancient saying that marriages are made in heaven? Well, one American couple, John Carter and Miriam Connolly, thought that since that was true, what could be more appropriate for wedding rings than rings made from parts of heaven? They decided that the customary gold bands just wouldn't do to symbolize their perfect union. So these two romantic souls put their heads and hearts together and came up with an idea. They'd have their wedding rings made from matter that sailed the seven seas of heaven among the stars. In other words, from meteors that had most likely been parts of stars themselves. But right here, the loving couple ran into a snag. Where could they find a meteorite? They asked their friends, but the friends didn't know. They inquired of jewelers. They consulted libraries, but no meteorite. Finally, somebody suggested the astronomy department of a university, and the astronomy professor there told them to go to the Hayden Planetarium of the American Museum in New York City. Well, sure enough, small pieces of meteorites could be bought at the planetarium, but the catch was to find a fragment that two rings could be made from. When the surface area of a fragment was large enough, its cross-section was too irregular, and when the top and bottom were sufficiently parallel, the surface was either too large or too small. After considerable looking around and trying to figure which piece of meteorite would be best, they finally purchased a fragment some 2 by 3 inches in area and about 1/2 inch thick. They paid $2.50 for it. The attendant at the planetarium told them that this piece was part of the huge meteorite that crashed in Arizona more than 20,000 years ago. The next thing these people were up against was finding someone to make the rings. Jewelers didn't want to do it, said they didn't have the tools for the job. So the couple hunted up a model craftsman. He said he'd try to make the rings, but he wouldn't promise anything. And this guy certainly tried. We can say that for him. You see, that meteorite was just about 95% iron and 5% nickel, plus a minute quantity of exceedingly hard impurities, which were presumably diamond particles. The rings cost $50 apiece, which is several times what it would cost to buy gold wedding rings of the same simple design. But the lovers didn't mind the extra expense. They considered the investment worth it because pieces of heaven were on their fingers and heaven was in their hearts. Well, I don't suppose I have to tell you that every business has its problems and risks, and the second-hand business is certainly no exception. Have you ever tried selling some of your old tables or chairs or what have you to a second-hand store? You may remember that when you offered your stuff to the dealer, he sized you up very carefully, asked you a lot of questions before he bought anything. He doesn't do this out of idle curiosity. He's doing it for a very sound reason, self-defense. The dealer in used merchandise wants to be very sure, before he buys anything, that it isn't stolen goods. And some second-hand dealers say that the more like an honest, law-abiding householder, a stranger with something to sell appears to be, the more it behooves the dealer to be on his guard and remember that motto the old Romans had, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. In some cities, at least, perhaps in all of them, I don't know, the dealer has to make a report to the police of the property he's bought from individuals. He's required to report such things as typewriters, sewing machines, musical instruments, and all merchandise that bears a serial number the day after he receives them. And he must wait a certain number of days before he sells them or disposes of them in any other way. The report blank that was used in Santa Monica, California in 1935, and which may still be in use so far as I know, called for the following data with regard to goods: amount paid, article, kind, color, size or length, number, inscription, or other mark. Regarding the person the deal was made with, name, address, sex, age, height, build, complexion, color and style of beard, and the color and style of dress. So, naturally, when a man or woman who's a perfect stranger greets a dealer with, would you be interested in buying thus and such? The dealer may scrutinize the lady or gentleman a bit more thoroughly than the etiquette books consider to be polite. But the dealer is trying to fix in his mind all those many points he needs to put into his report, particularly height and age, and the precautions he takes in the way of studying people train him to be, after a while, a pretty good judge of character. Even though a second-hand dealer all unknowingly buys something that's been stolen, he stands a chance of being involved in some unpleasant situation. Even if the thing isn't traced and the police haven't received any report of its loss, the possibility of trouble is still there. Let's say the dealer sells the article and the real owner sees it in somebody else's possession. This somebody has come by it honestly because they've paid good money for it in the second-hand store. The dispute that may result between the owner and the one who has the thing now may not be calmed down until the dealer appeases his customer by paying him to compensate him for having to give up the disputed thing to the person who claimed it. Suppose this article was reported as stolen to the police, and they find it listed on the report the dealer sends in. They bring the owner to the store. He identifies the article as belonging to him, and if he's a reasonable person, he knows the dealer didn't know the stuff was stolen when he bought it. Also, the owner is glad to have his property back, so he reimburses the second-hand dealer for what he paid to the thief, and the loser's wrath is generously taken by the owner. But if he isn't such a benevolent, reasonable person, if he's the kind who simply demands his property and doesn't give a hoot who loses just so he isn't the one, then the dealer and the claimant may have to settle the matter between themselves. The police, in locating the stolen goods, have done their part. Now their chief concern is to catch the thief. The dealer may end up by taking the entire loss, in which case about all he can do is grin and bear it. And he also resolves that he'll be more careful next time. You know, some years ago, a dealer innocently bought a more than 100-year-old spinning wheel that was in perfect condition for the small sum of $5. And a walnut table, one of those Victorian affairs with a marble top, for $4.50. He purchased them from a man, a plausible stranger, who told the dealer he was leaving town in something of a hurry, which, as a matter of fact, he did. The man said he couldn't be bothered with these family heirlooms. The fellow appeared to be honest and put up a convincing story. It afterwards developed that both the spinning wheel and the table had been pinched from his mother-in-law. The lady claimed the items a week or so later through the police. She was so pleased to get her treasures back that she gladly refunded the amount the dealer had paid the on-his-way son-in-law. Well, I haven't anyone's furniture to sell, but I better be on my way regardless. So just between us, that's it for today.
You've been listening to Knox Manning and another of his highly interesting and entertaining programs of storytelling. Mr. Manning will be back in a few days with more stories and anecdotes just between us. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education. Thank you.